Richard Martin's Wake Up Call Podcast, presented every Monday and Friday, providing you with the truth and the facts. You decide.
Hello again, everyone, and greetings and a warm welcome from Penang. I am Richard Martin, your host, and this is coming to you on Monday, August the 17th, 2015. Well, this is the last talk I shall be giving before our Destination Penang participants leave for Penang. It has been an exciting few weeks for my wife and her board at the International Women's Association of Penang. Everyone has been working very hard to make this tour a success, and they have a full schedule of lecturers and visits lined up each day next week. The purpose behind this is, of course, to prepare each participant for life in Penang in all its forms if and when our visitors decide to make Penang their homes. They will return to the US at the end of next week with a full portfolio of knowledge about how life works here, and they will have met a wide selection of people from the local community, both expats and locals. I want to touch on some of the guiding principles as to why I think it's so important to consider emigration from the US as your operative plan B, rather than this ridiculous prepping that people talk about when giving lip service to the idea that things may be a little difficult for a while. Okay, buy your food, buy your ammunition for your gun. What are you going to do when the food runs out and you've taken all the pot shots at these raving hordes of attackers and now the ammo's run out? All the proponents of these silly games have one thing in common. They just don't believe things are going to get that bad. For example, genetically modified food is illegal in many countries for health and medical reasons, while the US continues to pass laws making GMO labeling illegal. US citizens are being brainwashed daily and are being practically forced to consume GMOs, while countries like Austria, Bulgaria, Germany, Greece, Hungary, Ireland, Japan, Luxembourg, Madeira, New Zealand, Peru, Australia, Russia, France, and Switzerland have all booted Monsanto and their GMO crops out of their countries. That's like being thrown out of a town for being a rapist and child molester, only to have that same person settle into the next town down the road and become a grade school teacher or pastor. Now imagine the citizens of that other town having a law forced on them that says rapists and child molesters must be allowed to teach little kids and run churches. That's what we're talking about here. While society in other countries wakes up fully to the dangers of GMO food, Monsanto and other GMO food producers are having a feast in the US, buying out politicians, distorting news, research, and evidence that proves GMO food is directly linked to cancer. Really, it's like a scene from a bad movie, only it's not a movie. Actually, it's your life if you're in the United States dealing with this nightmare. As bizarre as it seems, only in the US do criminal corporations like Monsanto enjoy the benefits of the support of the political and legal system. A bird's eye view of the situation clearly shows how corrupt and evil the control system in the United States really is. Sadly, most Americans have no idea that they are being lied to every day and lured into eating dangerous, cancer-causing, and health-destroying food just so that the medical establishment can profit from your disease later on. Just look at the US government itself. It's really a sort of hideous giant corporation where financial losses are covered by you, the taxpayer, and the profits go to the operators of the political system. You know this. I'm not saying anything new. I'm just reminding you. We've talked endlessly about the country's dedication to war. This wide open confession came straight out of the mouth of US General Wesley Clark years after the illegal invasion of Iraq. The general openly spilled the beans on the US military's plan to invade 7 countries in the Middle East illegally under the lie of the war on terror. Shockingly, to this day, no war crimes trials have taken place. No one has been executed, convicted, or imprisoned for these massive crimes against humanity. Shockingly, the criminals even still make TV appearances and prance around the country offering their opinions and enjoying a comfortable life, appearing at events and speaking to the adoring citizenry. In fact, General Wesley Clark himself ended up being promoted to lead NATO units in the Middle East. He has even made recent propaganda appearances on TV, playing into the Jade Helm Master the Human Domain psyop, teasing freedom lovers with grim rhetoric about locking people up who don't agree with the US government. The United States military is currently conducting an admitted psychological operation on the human domain as people carry on as usual. It's called Jade Helm, and you need to understand that learning more about Jade Helm means putting down that remote control, turning off the ball game, pausing the video game, or missing your favorite TV show. It takes work to research this, and more importantly, the insecurity that comes with knowing that your own military is studying you, the individual, to control you is again too complicated to understand for some. This is another issue which is too overwhelming for the average person to understand, or, more importantly, to face fairly and squarely. SOCOM documents exposed by researchers are clear about the intention of Jade Helm, Jade 2 software, and no much how much you ignore it, it's still here, it's very real, and it's in motion as I speak. The entire debt-based fiat paper money circulating in the US is supplied and controlled by a private corporation with no constitutional authority to do so. We call them the Federal Reserve. It's the illegal private banking system created officially in 1913 under the Federal Reserve Act, to which Congress gave a green light. This single act essentially handed the United States of America to a gang of private bankers with no accountability to the people. Along with the Act of 1871, this Federal Reserve Act is also one of the most significant and horrific turning points in the history of America. An act that accounts for many of the problems and sufferings in America for now over 100 years. If enough people could finally wrap their heads around this single reality, that a private illegal mob of banksters have psyched out and enslaved Americans, fooling them into accepting their fiat currency while ensuring their perpetual enslavement, the full-on revolution would start today. The US has been caught numerous times militarily defending, arming, supplying, and training ISIS fighters. Here we are at the one-year anniversary of the ISIS Super PSYOP American TV marketing campaign, and today the ISIS PSYOP has been blown wide open. These reports trapping US and NATO governments in bold-faced staged lies and capturing solid evidence of their support for ISIS have gone completely ignored and censored by US mainstream media to keep the ISIS PSYOP narrative going in the minds of Americans. The situation is so controlled and America has been so brainwashed that even if every member of ISIS went on TV tomorrow exclusively expressing their partnership with the CIA and Mossad, the very next day US mainstream media would present another ISIS story telling you how much they are the enemy and need to be defeated. Make no mistake, this control system is completely immune and entirely unfazed by truth, hard evidence, and hard facts. Most people don't realize that government-inspired propaganda is perfectly legal. They don't realize that the US corporate fraudulent government can legally lie to you every single day to get you to believe whatever they want you to believe, and then turn around behind closed doors and laugh at you for believing their legal lies. Try telling that to most Americans and see how they look at you. This is another example of a hard-to-handle lie that is pushed on Americans every day, and the average working American has no time to truly wrap their heads around this stunning fact, so they bury their heads in the sand instead, unwilling to look at the issue because they fear they won't know what to do with the information. It's no wonder that today's TV shows and comedic rants are often shaped to put a positive slant on lying, to trivialize the seriousness and the consequences of lying. They even make lying seem like an evil necessity or even a cool trend. Most people are completely unaware of these subliminal messages that endorse the control of a government whose survival is dependent on continuous lies and deceit. Look, there's plenty more to talk about, painful details that I haven't even begun to delve into. But you can understand very easily, if you are of a mind to do so, that there is simply nothing you can do about any of this. The situation has deteriorated too much. We have long since passed the point of no return. There certainly was a time when the citizens of the United States could have changed things. That point has long since disappeared. Each of you must now turn inwards and protect yourselves and your loved ones. There is truly no time to lose. All right, well, for those 35 or younger, the typical net worth amount is $6,682, enough for 2 months of expenses in any large metro area. For those between 35 and 44, the mid-range is $35,000, enough for a new car. Between 45 and 54, it jumps to $84,000, enough for 4 years of college tuition for one kid. From 55 to 64, it jumps to $144,000, but this is largely due to housing. The same goes for the over 65 age range, with the typical net worth figure jumping to $171,000. The housing illusion of wealth in net worth figures is enormous. The housing industry uses this as the default answer as to why everyone should buy a home. But you can't afford a $250,000 home on the typical $50,000 household income? I rarely see financial analysts making this connection. They usually talk about net worth figures as if this was easily accessible liquid funds. They're not sitting in your bank account ready for access. If it is locked up in housing equity, you will need to sell the place before unlocking the funds. This means finding another place to buy or rent. This is critical here and also shows why the Fed is trying to boost the housing market at all costs. Of course, the unintended or intended consequence is that now more homes are owned by big investors, boosting their bottom line and only accelerating the destruction of the middle class. Homes are more expensive to buy, yet this is really the typical way most Americans build wealth. Without housing, most Americans have very little liquid wealth. Even the 55 to 64-year-old crowd only has $45,000 to their name once home equity is removed. For those 35 and younger, the millennial crowd is largely unable to buy without the help of rich parents, as studies are finding. What the results show is that most Americans are one medical emergency away from being flat broke. And this is data as of now, with a frothy stock market and a resurgent investor-driven housing bubble. Just imagine how things will look when the inevitable correction hits. Well, China is not a clone in the making of America's $18 trillion consume-till-you-drop economy, even if that model were stable and sustainable, which it is not. China is actually sui generis, a historical freak accident that has no destination other than a crash landing. Its leaders are neither wise nor deft economic managers. In fact, they are a bunch of Communist Party political hacks who have an iron grip on state power because China is a crude dictatorship. But their grasp of the fundamentals of economic law and sound finance cannot even be described as negligible. It's non-existent. Indeed, their reputation for savvy and successful economic management is an unadulterated Wall Street myth. The truth is, the 25-year-old growth boom in China is just a giant credit-driven Ponzi. Any fool can run a central bank printing press until it glows right hot. At the end of the day, that's all the Beijing stewards of red capitalism have actually done. They have not created any of the rudiments of viable capitalism. There are no honest financial markets, no genuinely solvent banks, no market-driven allocation of capital, and no financial discipline which comes from the right to fail as well as succeed. There are, for instance, 287 million equity trading accounts in China, most of them opened within the last year and overwhelmingly held by retail punters with sub-high school educations. In less than 12 months, they took down upwards of $1 trillion of margin debt through official brokerage channels and a massive network of shadow banking sources, including dodgy peer-to-peer lending arrangements. So fortified, they clambered after a stock market bubble that expanded by $3 trillion in just 60 trading days, ending on June the 14th, and then broke into a panicked selling stampede that liquidated that very same $3 trillion of bottled air in hardly 20 trading days thereafter. Then the state sent out the paddy wagons to arrest and intimidate the panicked sellers and threw open the central bank's credit lines to fund hundreds of billions of unwanted stocks. That's not capitalism, red or otherwise. It's desperate, mindless madness. Likewise, there are no credible institutions of contract law and bankruptcy. There is not even minimally honest corporate financial reporting, and no restraints at all on the propensity of China's newly affluent masses to gamble in real estate, stocks, commodity financing schemes, dodgy private lending clubs, chain letters, and endless similar get-rich-to-quick schemes. Most importantly, there are no lines of demarcation between the property of the state and the license of officialdom and their cronies to expropriate it. In a word, China wallows in the greatest cesspool of corruption known to history, because that's what happens when you erect a $10 trillion command economy virtually overnight. And the swaying edifice of red capitalism has indeed been stood up overnight. At the time that Mr. Deng radically changed the party line, proclaiming that it is glorious to be rich, and the PBOC slashed the renminbi exchange rate by 60% in 1994 in order to jumpstart an export boom, there was less than one half of a trillion dollars of credit market debt outstanding. Alas, that figure today is $28 trillion, according to the cautious reckoning of McKinsey, and most likely far more. You see, here's the thing. You cannot safely, sanely, or efficiently grow by 56 times in hardly two decades something as combustible as cheap, come-and-get-it state-supplied credit in an environment where the rudiments of market capitalism do not even exist. If you pursue that kind of financial Frankenstein, that's exactly what you will get. And that's what the comrades in Beijing actually got. Now, however, the iron law of financial bubbles has caught up with them. That is, when you stop supplying increasingly massive amounts of new credit to what eventually becomes an elephantine bubble, it begins to fall inward. This happens slowly at first, then with increasing and accelerating momentum, and finally culminates in a panic-riven meltdown.
Share the truth. Invite others to listen to Richard Martin's wake-up call. Richard Martin produces his shows single-handedly, based on his extensive reading and research. Every week, Richard gives you the facts with no spin, for you to make informed decisions on world events that will affect your life. Now, let's get back to today's show.
One of the reasons young people can't make money, it seems to me, is because their education is a farce. They're fed no real information about money or debt. They are psychologically massaged into believing that all is well, that huge college debt is normal and can be paid off, that the job which can make that happen is just around the corner. In addition, college loans allow these kids to use the money for all kinds of non-college purposes, even partying, all of which, of course, promotes the worst of atmospheres and delusional realities. They turn the debt gun over to idiot freshmen and allow them to commit financial suicide with it. And these banksters, shysters, think they're doing a great job trapping kids this way, all for their own profit, of course. Most of the classes don't even require you to show up, and many, the online ones, also inspire the sleep-in mentality. So if you can pull from a decent grade without even going, just by reading a book and or the professor's blackboard requirements, you don't need the forced work ethic of actually physically making yourself go somewhere you don't necessarily want to go. The kids come out of college with a shockingly small amount of saleable knowledge and, of course, almost no work experience or proof that they can actually get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and work until 6 p.m. day after day. The ones that are trying to think for themselves are all wrapped up in global warming and gay rights and other things that they're encouraged to think they know so much about. Such things, of course, that the powers that be want them to have all riled up about, so they don't spend too much time learning about debt, non-toxic food, and other irrelevant things. Now you have a huge pool of kids vying for too few decent jobs. Mind you, the sole sellers will always make money in financial, pharmaceutical, the military-industrial complex jobs, etc. But the regular jobs are paying peanuts. It's all a question of supply and demand. This generation is truly screwed. Congratulations to the adults who did it to them. Your lunatic prize is on the way. Well, central banks have been expanding the money supply and had their foot to the floor. Yet economies across the world are not even close to escape velocity. Lessons from the financial world are being doled out rather rapidly these days, and it's best to pay close attention. They include new terms like bank bail-ins, where you can be given a very expensive haircut to clawbacks, a term referring to how a deal isn't over even after it's over. And who among us has not recoiled in amazement to discover the so-called free market in China that did not rebound after several massive attempts by the Chinese government to resuscitate it? The last time the market rebounded, it was after the government threatened to arrest and imprison short sellers. The massive debt load is not receding or going away, it is merely being transferred to the public sector, where those in charge of such things feel it will be more benign. The most recent solution to Greece's debt crisis stands as a monument to the concept that if creative financing isn't creative, then what is it? This question makes sense when positioned with other such deep philosophical questions like, how much wood would a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood? Returning to the issue of creative financing in many ways, it has become mind-bogglingly crazy. Creative financing can be so out there that it's hard to get your head around and makes absolutely no sense. At times, it falls into the same logic of the great movie line from The Field of Dreams, "Build it and they will come," a logically sounded rooted in faith and little else. The problem with the "build it and they will come" is that often they don't come. Those who have made such an investment often come to regret it. Europeans will have to pony up even more cash to keep the lights on in Greece. Until now, the countries of the Eurozone that hold this debt have been resistant to acknowledging to the world the giant scam that they have enabled. While those in charge appear undaunted by what is occurring, the fact is by a series of off-book and backdoor transactions, they have transferred this loss from the banks onto the shoulders of the people. All this has been done through actions they can only defend by talking in terms of the greater good, or by conjuring up images of a horrible financial Armageddon that might have occurred had they not taken this course. It appears the world has passed the point of no return when it comes to the experiment in monetary manipulation. Modern monetary theory, also known as MMT, was to be the salvation and a tool to even out economic cycles. But instead, it has morphed into a massive debt machine that drives the economy forward. We may soon rue the day we started down this path, for where it leads to a very bleak place. Those in charge of the economy have made the mistake of thinking markets are like clay that can be molded. This is in conflict with the law of economics, where in reality markets are like water and will always seek and find their own level, no matter who or what tries to control them. One lesson should be clear by now, which is that no limits exist in length to the length of those in charge will go to maintain the appearance of stability. Sadly, debt does matter, and we may soon run out of places to hide it. A very strong case could be made that a plethora of new tools added the central bank's toolboxes over the last decade have masked and distorted the economic landscape. This can be seen in the explosion of derivatives, more debt leveraging, and in the growing carry trade. It is a fact that unproven tools can produce damaging results when not prudently applied. Still, efforts to extend and pretend seem almost unlimited. When we see how quickly those in charge are ready to give bank depositors haircuts, we should not be reassured. Instead, we should be frightened and see this as a glimpse of how we might be treated when they turn their sights on us. When a bubble pops, it's leverage that almost always proves so corrosive and destabilizing on the way down. We will soon move rapidly from the realm of insane denial rounding the corner to find we have arrived at an area of utterly obvious crisis. In November 2014, the national debt was poised to pass the $18 trillion mark. As we approach the middle of August 2015, the national debt clock shows more than $340 billion has been added to the total, and the amount owed continues to grow. This appears to be raising no red flags, as we continue to hear from the media how robust economic growth has helped push the US budget deficit down to the lowest level since 2008. Claims of the sharpest turnaround in the government's fiscal position in at least 46 years are targeted at reassuring Americans that Washington has got your back. A trick used to confuse the issue and muddy the waters is which administration or president is used to dump the massive 2009 deficit on. Bush left office with the economy in the sewer, but the resulting deficit occurred on Obama's watch. Over the last few years, the Obama administration has touted how the edifice is dropping and the economy is on the mend. This has led some Americans into thinking the worst of the problems are now in the rearview mirror. According to figures released by the U.S. Treasury, the federal government has officially run a deficit of $589 billion for the first 11 months of fiscal year 2014. We should remember this number is for public consumption, and it relies on accounting tricks which massively understate how much debt is really being accumulated. If you want to know what the real budget deficit is, all you have to do is go to a U.S. Treasury website which calculates the U.S. national debt. On November 1st, 2013, the U.S. national debt was sitting at 17,108,598,955. Just a year later, on October the 1st, 2014, that number has risen to 17,937,160,394,672. That means today many people seem to have little desire to cut spending. The country is literally gorging on debt. And most Americans seem to think that it's just fine and dandy to wildly run up debt as if there were no tomorrow. The myth that, and a scare scenario of growth coupled with a falling deficit, will allow you to outgrow many of the problems you face, brings with it a false optimism and hope. I have run into more than one person who touts the fact the deficit is coming down and interprets this as proof of everything will be all right. Negotiating the financial cliff and muddling through what was described as a draconian sequestration has emboldened many Americans and left them feeling immune to economic reality. This is the foundation of a financial disaster. Sadly, the reality is the country continues to run up massive record deficits, and it merely kicks the can of reckoning down the road. Projections made by the government or any group predicting budgets based on events that may or may not happen at some future date are simply that, projections or predictions, not fact. This means that such numbers are totally unreliable. Data compiled by Bloomberg using Commerce Department figures would lead a person to think things are getting better. They tout a shortfall of only $483.4 billion in the 12 months ended September the 30th, 2013, noting it was only 2.8% of the nation's gross domestic product of $17.2 trillion. The ratio peaked at 10.1% of GDP in December 2009. Data shows the fourth quarter of 2008 was the last time the deficit to GDP share reached 2.8% was in April 2005. According to George Consalves, head of interest rate strategy at Nomura Holdings, Inc. in New York, and I quote, "That's what happens when the government is holding itself back on spending and the economy is improving. The question is that as good as it gets, or will the deficit continue to shrink?" End of quote. A major concern for Gonsalves is that in 2017, entitlements are poised to balloon, causing a massive spike in government spending. Any claim that the Obama administration has the budget deficit back under control is a total lie. We are mired in the midst of the greatest government debt bubble in the history of the world. Well, hey, I'll say something about Donald Trump. He's an expert at declaring bankruptcy. Isn't that what America needs right now? Someone who really knows how to jump out of a boiling pot? When the going gets tough, Trump stiffs his creditors. He's done it four times. The man knows his way out of a paper bag. Isn't this precisely what the land of the free needs right now? Someone who can stop beating about the bush and just get on with it already? Seriously, though, as history shows, a default is inevitable. The calculus is quite simple. When governments take on too much debt, they start having to divert a huge amount of their tax revenue just to pay interest. This means that, at a minimum, the government has to sacrifice many of the promises they made to their citizens. They cut other programs in order to have enough money to pay interest. But that's not too popular, is it? So instead, they typically just borrow more money, until they're borrowing money just to pay interest on the money they've already borrowed. This makes the problem exponentially worse. Debt skyrockets, and soon the government is spending more on interest payments than national defense. The US is almost at this point. Eventually, a bankrupt government has no choice. Either default on your bondholders, or default on the obligations you've made to your citizens, or both. This could take the form of a selective default. For example, the US government could default on the $2.4 trillion that it owes the Federal Reserve, or the $1.1 trillion that it owes China. These are both possibilities. But the prospect of default on risk-free US government bonds would throw the global financial system into a tailspin, not to mention it would be the final nail in the coffin for the US dollar's dominant reserve status. Fortunately, there are easier options for Uncle Sam. The biggest debts that are owed by the US government are the obligations they owe to you. Specifically, all the benefits like Social Security and Medicare they promised to American taxpayers. The US government's own numbers estimate these obligations at nearly $42 trillion, completely dwarfing what they owe China or anyone else. Then there's the obligation they have to preserve the purchasing power of the $12 trillion held by the American people. That's the current value of the money supply in the United States right now. History shows that debasing a nation's currency is one of the easiest and most effective ways for bankrupt governments to plunder their citizens' wealth, little by little, over time. The hard reality that most people don't seem to get is that the US government is bankrupt. This isn't some wild assertion or conspiracy theory. Their own financial statements show that the government's net worth is negative by $17.7 trillion. And yes, the US is already borrowing money just to pay interest. In fact, the combined expenses of interest on the debt plus mandatory entitlements like Social Security nearly exceed their entire tax revenue. In other words, you could eliminate nearly everything we think of as government, the EPA, the IRS, Homeland Security, etc., and it wouldn't make the slightest dent in the national debt. When things get this dire, it doesn't matter who sits in the chair. You might as well elect a chimpanzee in the hopes that Mr. Bubbles might accelerate the decline. Donald Trump may very well be that chimpanzee. He's got a leg up on his fellow orangutans, his paralleled or unparalleled experience in declaring bankruptcy. Google was recently requested to divulge the email address of a Gmail subscriber who was sent information by a bank in error. The Gmail subscriber did not reply to the bank's request. So, to cut a long story short, the bank obtained a court order ordering Google to deactivate the recipient's Gmail account temporarily and disclose information about the account to the court and to the bank. Days later, Google and the bank jointly announced that the issue had been resolved. But because of the court order, the user's email account has to remain deactivated until the judge hears the case again on October the 5th. Needless to say, this is ridiculous. And it just points up the need for you to ensure that the computer server where your email is hosted, as well as the company which owns or manages the servers, are both outside your country of residence and citizenship. For example, if the Gmail recipient in our story had been using an email account in, say, Singapore or Switzerland, the chances of a foreign judge ordering the account to be deactivated are slim to none, with slim, of course, being out of town. With a properly configured account, you can switch to an offshore provider and still keep your existing email address. Here's one link to a provider whose server is located abroad. You might want to write this down. http://www.mbox.com.sg. Let me repeat that. http://www.mbox.com.sg. Now remember, this doesn't provide privacy or security. You'll need encryption for that. Well, at this point, it's impossible to repair the global economy. We're so far down the proverbial rabbit hole that it's extremely unlikely we'll be able to stop the carnage. The global economic meltdown is supplying a perfect example of how sustainability cannot be guided by today's values. The economic crash is occurring because too many financial entities become disconnected from fundamental values and long-term sustainable thinking. The crux of the matter is that banks, lenders, borrowers, and shareholders pursued short-term relationships on the only premise of the values of the day. However, when current values are based on quick gains in profit, you end up in the situation that we're in. Plain and simple, we've become our own worst enemy. And I can tell you this, for whatever reason, whenever some major disaster occurs of epic proportions in history, you never seem to hear the historic narrative that everyone knew it was coming and got prepared. Before the Great Depression, as far as I'm aware, you cannot find New York Times headlines that proclaim, "The Fed is warning one last time, get prepared now." Or, "How many days left until the bottom falls out?" A lot of bad decisions with seemingly no consequences, euphoria, and the feeling of societal invincibility are probably what precede most epic disasters. Thus the saying, "No one saw it coming." Well, I was having a drink with Louis Baroud here the other day. Louis is here visiting Penang. We talked about what happens to all of those who have borrowed through doubling down into a 30-year-plus declining rate environment. I've mentioned this before, but I think it's worthwhile going through the process once again. Let me remind you how this can work and has worked over the last more or less 30 years, all the way back to the very high inflation days of the early 1980s. Let's say you are a business and you need some additional capital for an expansion program you have in mind. You borrow $1 million at an interest rate of 10%, which, I remind you, was a very good rate at that time. As you know, you must pay $100,000 in interest a year to keep that loan outstanding. Now, the rate of interest falls to 5%. You have a choice. You could halve your interest payment on the $100,000 loan and pay $50,000 in interest. Or you could borrow another million and spend it, keeping the payment at $100,000. Even if you don't really need the money, the temptation to borrow the extra money at no additional cost to yourself is very tempting, isn't it? Which do you think both corporations and governments did? They borrowed the second million and spent it. Now the rate falls to 2.5%. You could, once again, pay $50,000 in interest, or you could borrow another $2 million. Again, what do you think they did? Yes, there is now $4 million outstanding that has been spent with absolutely no increase in interest to pay. This continues until today, when so-called good credits can borrow at 1%. Instead of $1 million, you can now have $10 million outstanding. And the cruel reality is that most of these firms and governments do. Well, I can already see a problem. What if you've miscalculated badly and the result of the extra capital does not produce the goods? What if you are even losing money on the extra money you borrowed? This is nothing short of a catastrophe for you, isn't it? But here's something worse. What happens if interest rates now start to rise? What happens when the rate of interest goes to 2% from 1% for those good credits, a mere 1% rise? The interest payment required to keep the $10 million outstanding doubles to $200,000. If you can't come up with it, then the only way to reduce it, other than bankruptcy, is to pay down $5 million of the $10 million you have outstanding. But you don't have $5 million. You spent it. That was, after all, the entire point of borrowing it in the first place. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the trap. And from the size of it, you can see the problem the Fed has. Even a modest interest rate rise in rates from 1% will drive good credit borrowing costs in the short term to roughly 2% or so, which will instantly double the interest due or force a pay down of half of the debt outstanding. Now perhaps you can understand the horror of even the tiniest increase in interest rates. The mainstream won't be telling you this, so don't hurry to your nearest national rag to get confirmation of what I'm saying. You and millions of others will unfortunately find this out the hard way. Now you can perhaps understand one of the reasons why they all what they like about the economic recovery. They simply can't afford to have you stop spending. And the mainstream is expected to go along with this, which of course they do enthusiastically. Again, let me remind you, the media couldn't care less about you. Okay, well, let's take a couple of emails before we finish up today. First of all, one from, well, anonymous, as far as I can see. Can't see I wrote one down. Anyway, hello, Mr. Martin. Hopefully you receive this correspondence at your new email address. 1. Circa a decade ago, I graduated with a degree in journalism. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to enter the journalism field. This year, I rematriculated in school to ameliorate my situation and pull myself out of a rut I have been in for years. Since I'm not smart enough to be an engineer, I am pursuing nursing. Lately, I have been flirting with the idea of trying to put my journalism degree to use as a TV reporter or journalist. To my knowledge, the medical field is growing. In your neck of the woods, how are the opportunities for broadcast journalism, or am I better off pursuing nursing? Let me just answer that quickly. In my neck of the woods, in Malaysia, I am completely unclear about journalism. I've never been involved with it, so I couldn't answer that question. I wouldn't rely on journalism as a reason, however, to come to Penang. Nursing, on the other hand, is in demand. There are always job opportunity for nurses in places like Penang, Kuala Lumpur, Johor Bahru, big cities in Malaysia. And so I would be far more enthusiastic about looking for work as a nurse. Okay, two. I am not the type who makes friends. Call me a misanthrope or whatever you desire, but friends are only around when they want something from you. Thus, I do my damnedest to ensure I depend on nobody. Since 2011, I have been peripatetic. Currently, I have been in a 3-year resident of an area that boasts of low unemployment. However, to get some of the plum jobs, one must have connections. Cliquishness pisses me off to no end. Ever since I was 10, I have come to terms that life sucks. However, I don't believe in kissing ass to get ahead. In regard to finding good employment, would I encounter cliquishness in Penang or what? In Penang, there are really three different ethnic groups, as there are in all parts of Malaysia, with the Chinese being predominant population clique, or I wouldn't call it a clique, I'd call it more an ethnic group, although clearly as the preponderant group, it does have sway in many of the decisions that are made in Penang. Then you have the Malays that correspond to less than 40% of the whole, and they, of course, are predominant by virtue of the fact that the country is Malaysia and the national language is Malay, albeit here in Penang, almost everybody speaks English. The third group are the Indians, who are really a tiny group and are noticeable for their colourful dress and their excellent Indian restaurants. So in terms of the Westerners, they are a fairly negligible group too, but they are always in demand. People always look up to Westerners, and you will find yourself listened to extremely avidly if you have advice to give to any of these groups. So I would say that as a clique, you will not find anybody discriminating against you. They don't even discriminate against each other. So I really wouldn't fear that. I think Penang could be an ideal environment for you, especially as you don't seem to want to depend on the kindness of strangers or friends. You probably will be well placed here, if that is your wish. All right, so then to continue, let me see where I am here. Okay, in your in your podcasts, you mentioned Penang is a developed area. I watched a few YouTube videos on Penang. From what I watched, Penang appears to be a crowded area. How often does it experience tsunamis? Never heard of a tsunami in Penang, actually. Maybe they do experience them, but I'm not aware of it, and I haven't heard of the experience of anyone who has. B. What is the source of its prosperous economy? Manufacturing. Many companies have manufacturing headquarters here in Penang. That's local companies. Many multinationals have their Asian headquarters in Penang because the Penangites, being predominantly Chinese, are very hard workers. So they're very reliable, they're very dependable. So there are a lot of manufacturing facilities here, and they are extremely prosperous, which gives rise to some jealousy from the rest of the country, but nevertheless, it makes Penang a very interesting place to be. It's not actually that crowded. It may seem that way, but there are plenty of places, especially on the western side of the island, which are virtually deserted, where you can live, and the travel to the other side is never more than about half an hour. So there are plenty of places to live which are not overcrowded. Okay, that's part of question B. What measures does it have implemented as bulwarks against its oligarchs extortionately enriching themselves to the detriment of the hoi polloi? Well, now you have to remember this is a third world country, so that really doesn't apply here. It's just not the same as a Western country where there are these huge disparities in wealth. C. I don't believe Penang is welcoming every Tom, Dick and Harry with open arms. What countries or peoples are Penang restricting from immigration and for what reasons? They are restricting the refugees coming in from neighbouring Thailand and Indonesia and Burma or Myanmar. That's basically it. Everyone else is welcomed with open arms, and you will not find any discrimination at all applied to you. So don't worry about that. Ladies and gentlemen, we have arrived at the end of another show. So let me wish all the participants coming to Destination Penang a wonderful trip. Don't forget the jet lag pills. They really do work. We're all really looking forward to seeing you all. Lots and lots of interesting and fun things lined up for you. Bring those capes. We've been having lots of rain lately, so you probably won't regret it. And oh, did you remember to notify your credit card company that you're going to Malaysia? It could save you a lot of hassle by not having your card declined at the point of sale because your credit card provider thinks a thief got hold of it and ran off to Malaysia. And to the rest of you, have a great week. I'll be back on Friday with more of the same. Take care, everyone. This is Richard Martin signing off and going to bed. Bye-bye.